Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 11th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here at UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is 67 degrees and very humid here in upstate New York. Looks like we are going to be feeling some of the dog days of summer here coming up soon, with indexes up around 100 degrees, so it's going to be kind of unpleasant for the next few days. But hey, I'm not complaining. Where do we leave off? Yesterday, we titled the show, The Internet of Everything as Biology's Enslavement, and yeah, that about encompasses all of what we talked about. We had looked at whether or not we would be willing to take the chip in regards to a story that was co-written by MIT Labs for a very mainstream publication called Big Think. And they've really been rolling out the red carpet, trying to get everyone to embrace and get excited about this new technology that is going to be able to manipulate and control biology to the point where they can cure us of things that we never thought possible. They'll be able to manipulate our brain chemicals and our cellular chemicals, our DNA, splice and dice out diseases, add superhuman powers at some point in the future or in some dark, scary back room. And that really is the new world of the future that is coming at the very end of that story about questioning whether or not you would be willing to take the chip. It had pretty much said that whether you like it or not, it is coming, and you need to make the decision whether you're going to be one of those people that either steps right up or, with the threat of impending doom and death at the end of your life, would you be willing to take a chance, roll the dice, and extend yourself by getting some sort of cyborg implant? So I wanted to continue. I think we read about two paragraphs from the story at the very end of the show yesterday. We're going to continue looking at cellular biology and the merging with technology and how this is kind of connecting also through this artificial intelligence and biological synthetic created technology that is coming. I mean, skin jobs from the Battlestar Galactica series, the new one, aren't too far off from that concept. They will be able to create life with the synthetic genome. Good old George Church at the Broad Institute, working with Harvard and MIT with CRISPR technologies. He's also working on bringing back the woolly mammoth. I watched an entire documentary on that, actually. Didn't realize who George Church was. Didn't know that it had anything to do with him, but in the documentary, they had gone through looking for the perfect elephant surrogate for birthing this woolly mammoth. They had found some DNA frozen in some fossils, and they were able to find strands that were complete enough to be able to do the sequencing to create, I don't know if it was an egg or if they're just going to splice and dice some of the differences in DNA into an actual elephant embryo. Not quite sure how that was all working out, but they're really making this happen. So guys, you know, when we saw the movie probably 20, 25 years ago, Jurassic Park, and everyone's like, oh, that could never happen, or oh, maybe that could happen. Well, now we're at the point where it's like, well, it is going to happen. Not saying dinosaurs, but holy mammoths are pretty close. So the story we ended with yesterday is titled, Scientists Build a Biological Computer Inside of a Cell. Again, MIT is in the thick of all of this. They got their grubby little hands. Remember, that is the home of nanotechnology and Eric Drexler. And just because we haven't talked about nanotech in a while doesn't mean that there's not a lot going on. Nanotech, though, is just so small that it's not a technology in and of itself anymore. It's a technology that's been integrated already into all of these other technologies. It's become a part of synthetic biology. It's become a way to release payloads of whatever substance you're getting into the organism. So they can, like, in regards to genetic engineering, we've looked quite a bit at it and a lot of the different ways that we've been doing it historically and now with CRISPR. But in the old days, they were using viruses that they sucked the guts out of, and then they would replace the guts with something else. So the virus itself was inactivated, but the mechanism of being a virus was not. So viruses are very good at invading cells, so they would use that as the Trojan horse to get it past the immune system and into the body. And viruses can scan cells and look for weaknesses to be able to get inside. But once inside, their payload is released, and there's your Trojan horse. So inside that payload is where they have now been using all of these different nanotechnologies, whether it be nanoparticles, which are one thing, or nanobots, which are another. And, you know, in the beginning, I talked about this. I had always kind of envisioned my vision of the future of nanobots. There was that movie about, I don't remember what it was called, but they went into a little miniaturized spaceship inside of the body, and they did the, I don't know, it was something like the Grand Journey or the something like that. But if you've never seen it, I'll have to find the name of it and tell you tomorrow. Because if you haven't seen it, it's pretty amazing. But they traveled through the inside of the body, so I had always imagined in my head that they would be these little robots, these little spaceships that would be in our blood. And we have seen, they have these little mini fish now. They look like little fish robots, and they wiggle their tails, and they can right up in through your bloodstream and get to where they have to go. But they're also making nanobots out of DNA now, and that came out of the Weiss Institute. Again, we've talked about them so many times, biologically inspired engineering. And they have been able to create these little robots using this folding origami. And I think we actually hit a story about that yesterday. There was some other origami robot. I think there was the swallowable pill that can walk around inside living creatures, right, to go retrieve things. How insane is that? Same sort of concept, except at a nano level and inside of our bloodstream or inside of our bodies. And these things can be programmed. Talked about that. There's a whole programming language for cells. Well, here, this is a brand new article, July 21st, 2016, so about 3 weeks old. Scientists build a biological computer inside of a cell. MIT engineers have developed biological computational circuits capable of both remembering and responding to sequential input data. The group's work, which is described in this week's issue of Science, represents a critical step in the progression of synthetic biology with the integration of DNA-based memory. What? Oh my God, synthetic biology with an integration of DNA-based memory. In particular, pointing the way toward building large computational systems from biological components, computing devices that are living cells, and ultimately programming complex biological functions. Guys, you know, I used to laugh when we first read that story back maybe 3 years now ago about being able to store things such as silly cat pictures in DNA strands and using DNA storage. You know, I had imagined it as, I think they had said it was maybe in like a teaspoon of DNA. They would be able to store every action that has ever occurred on Earth from the beginning of time. Like, it was some incredible amount of information for a million years if they encased them in glass. It was just some incredible number. And I had imagined in my head, again, Jill, don't do that, you get into trouble. I had imagined something more akin to a Jabba the Hutt sitting in the NSA spying headquarters, collecting dragnet data on every living creature on the planet. Now let's add to that the Internet of Everything, all the way down to every cell and DNA strand in our bodies, all of our biometrics and internal processes, up to the minute real time. Biosensors, we've talked about that a lot. Of course, yesterday we looked at the history of how this has evolved. So we have our smart devices, then we have our wearables, and then we have our implantables. But as we look at all this data, DNA storage seemed like that was the answer. And it appears to me that they have gone way beyond DNA storage. They were making DNA electronic circuits about a week ago in a story we read. And now all of a sudden, yes, we have computing devices that are living cells. Like, you're going to have a living creature in your hand. You're going to have a living AI, guys. Do you understand? Understand what this implies for fast forward 20 years in the future? Biological computing devices that are alive. So, you know, when we kind of joked about whether or not we give robots ethics, we throw them out a window. You know, they were arguing that at some point, especially as we're giving now robots VPUs for vision processing units, I saw they were giving them also this free will module that allows them to make their own decisions based upon environmental conditions. Now they can also start to feel things and pain. Remember that one from a few weeks back? They're going to start building pain into some robots so they can feel sensation. They're going to become more and more alive. And once they turn that tin, metal, aluminum, whatever the hell they use on them, titanium, into some sort of biological synthetic hybrid cell that can be programmed, and it's considered to be alive by definition, we have huge problems. We have created a completely new life form. Guys, this is not good for the human race. They will be smarter and stronger and potentially bigger and a lot scarier than us. And what always happens when a more advanced race comes into contact with a less advanced race is that you become enslaved and typically slaughtered. This is not a good thing for us. Anyway, back to the story. So these are computing devices that are living cells and ultimately programming complex biological functions. More specifically, Nathaniel Rocket, with a Q-U-E-T, Rocket, and colleagues at MIT's Synthetic Biology Group were able to implement within a living cell what is known as a state machine, an abstract mathematical model describing computation as a list of distinct internal states paired with an associated list of operations or machine inputs required to transition from state to state. So, a new state is always the result of an old state taken in combination with new inputs. And state machines happen to describe a very large number of different things, from natural language processing algorithms to neurological systems to something as simple as a vending machine. In a living cell, DNA is the natural candidate for storing state information. After all, that is what DNA does. It stores information. What Roquette and company have created is a framework for chemically manipulating DNA, ding, 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 such that states are encoded in DNA sequences. As a storage mechanism, this allows for both conveniently reading out a given state via genetic sequencing and also regulating gene expression via state transitions. In other words, the states can be linked to cellular behavior. The DNA serves as the memory for the state machine, and the rest is in how specifically the DNA is manipulated and what effect that has on its cellular behavior. In their experiments, Roquette and company programmed good old E. coli. You know, E. coli has been in a lot of these different programmable cellular experiments. And E. coli is so prevalent in the environment. You know, what happens when, we've asked this before about other things, what happens when some of these genies get out of the bottle and into the wild? What happens when some of the stuff is released and it starts reproducing or causing mutations in a general population? You know, where are the level 4 controls, biohazard controls for all of this stuff? Because to me, it seems like this is wantonly happening in these university labs. And I mean, I think that the university has some smart people, but remember, these people are all being funded and fueled by large investors such as DARPA or Bill Melinda Gates Foundation or some other rich tech billionaire who wants to, or funding group, or globalist organization who has a vested interest in there being positive results. And since they've gotten rid of liabilities in a lot of biopharma for vaccinations, and a lot of this technology can be considered gene therapy, and really that is kind of where the whole new vaccine quote-unquote technology is going, is as immunotherapies. You know, once you step up and you check that box that you want to be part of that trial, you want to take that chance and roll the dice to be able to live longer, to be able to be smarter, to be able to have traits, to fix your limbs, to be able to mind control your prosthetic, to be able to connect to the cloud, to be able to have superpowers, to wave your hands, to pay for food, and unlock your door, and authenticate as they get us to step right up and to take this technology. They are benefiting from every single piece of data that they garner from us, and it's not going to be for our benefit at all. In their experiments, we're cut and company programmed E. coli cells to react to several substances commonly used in biological laboratory experiments, including an analog of the antibiotic. Tetracycline. Now, wait a minute. See, this is what they were using with the GMO Zika mosquitoes as well. Tetracycline is like the kill switch. And they found there was a lot of tetracycline in the environment already because of its use in farm animals and our overuse from physicians and healthcare professionals. They're also using a sugar called arabinose and a chemical called DAPG that helps plants protect their roots from pathogens. The cells could be reprogrammed to other inputs as needed, however. The actual cell behavior being programmed by the researchers was the expression of gene coding for the production of different fluorescent proteins representing different colors with three different inputs. And they were able to produce 16 different combinations of color. Synthetic state machines that record and respond to sequences of signaling and gene regulatory events within a cell could be transformative tools in the study and engineering of complex living systems, Roquette writes. In other words, by implementing a state machine or computer in a living cell, it is possible to use that state machine to surveil otherwise impossible to observe cellular happenings. Ding, 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 ding. It is the body monitoring. It is synthetic biology, and once they can write to cells and program them to do things, what is going to stop them from not only creating their own life form, but from getting these cells into us? For example, progenitor cells, which are very similar to stem cells, develop into differentiated cell types within specific functions thanks to transcription factors, proteins that help regulate gene expression in cells. Transcription factors have allowed researchers to program both progenitor cells to become certain specific types of functional cells, and we've seen that with stem cells. We can coax them with some chemical soup and make them into any type of stem cell right from our skin, for any of our organs or eyeballs, whatever we want, mini brain balls they've been able to make. It's pretty amazing. But they also do the opposite, program functional cells to behave as undifferentiated cells. That's pretty interesting. However, much about the process still remains a mystery. So, you know, we're the all-knowing, all-seeing scientists. But don't let us fool you like we know what we're really doing. We're just kind of messing around, and you happen to be our guinea pig, but step right up. A state machine could record the DNA transitions resulting from TF activation, and it could go a long way toward not only understanding these processes, but manipulating them as well. The circuits in the biological state machine are dependent on enzymes called recombinases. These enzymes are activated by various inputs into a cell, such as chemical signals, to tweak the cell's DNA. But the tweak that actually occurs depends on the orientation of two DNA sequences known as recognition sites. And the important thing is that the effect of changing any two recognition sites depend on how other recognition sites have been altered previously, hence memory. There is no shortage of potential applications here. The example Roquette gives is in integrating biological state machines into tumor models where they may be used to genetically surveil the activation of oncogenes, genes that may cause cancer, and deactivation of tumor suppression mechanisms in individual cells. So they like literally would be able to monitor cell functioning at a real-time level. This idea that we can record and respond to not just combinations of biological events, but also their orders, opens up a lot of potential applications. Roquette offers in a statement, "A lot is known about what factors regulate differentiation in specific cell types or lead to the progression of certain diseases, but not much is known about the temporal organization of those factors." That's one of the areas we hope to dive into with our device. They want to be able to find the timing and be able to manipulate that timing to create a different outcome. Computers have become alive. That's what it says. But perhaps not in the way many of us anticipated. And yes, not in our wildest, scariest dreams. A unicellular organism itself won't ever be packing much computational horsepower, but considered as a building block, and the potential is pretty wild. So how insane is that? We can make cells, we can program to do things, and to be able to read and surveil real time within the cell and record what is happening, utilizing DNA as a storage medium. What? Yeah, that's what we just read. That's going on at MIT. You want to talk about some more weirdness? Here's one. This actually came up in chat the other day. I'd seen this story a couple times, but there was a brand new update on this. Cyborg stingray swims toward the light and breaks new ground. Yeah, they built a cyborg stingray out of rat's heart cells. The idea of taking apart a rat's heart. This is some of this Tower of Babel shit. This is insane. The idea of taking apart a rat's heart and transforming it into a tissue-engineered stingray first came to Kevin Kit Parker during a trip to New England's aquarium with his daughter. And 4 years later, a robotic stingray that swims toward light has made the cover of Science magazine and is pushing the limits of what is possible in the design of machines powered by living cells. Ding, ding, ding. Guys, this genie is already out of the bottle, and this is very frightening. They are making biological machines. They are programming cells and coaxing them into whatever they want. Remember that last story you just said? They can take something that's like a stem cell and they can create any type of cell, differentiated or non-differentiated, and then program instructions into it to do things, and to monitor and surveil things, and to store information in a memory, a DNA memory that is then retrievable and readable by DNA sequencing gear. It's just astonishing. A research team based at, of course, Harvard University's Disease Biophysics Group, which Parker directs, creates the translucent penny-sized ray with a gold skeleton and silicone fins layered with the heart muscle cells of a rat. It's remote controlled. Another remote controlled cyborg. Remember, we covered that story where they embedded those nanowires into a pupa of a moth, and then the moth grew with these nanowires into its brains and muscles. They were able to remote control this thing once it was full grown. Very scary. So now they can remote control rat heart cells on a golden skeleton with silicone fins. This little remote controlled robot. It's remote controlled and guided by a blinking blue flashlight. And each burst of blue sets off a cascade of signals throughout the cells, which have been genetically engineered to respond to light. Now remember, they did that to the brain of a mouse as well. And that was in order to remove and replace memories with the flashes of light on genetically engineered brain cells that had been engineered to react toward light. The contraction of this rat heart tissue creates a downward motion on the ray's body, and when the tissues relax, the gold skeleton recoils, moving the fins upward again in an undulating cycle that mimics the graceful swimming of a real stingray. Now think about this. Again, the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, I'm sure that somewhere in there, they might have had a hand in this, and they've been stealing nature's ideas now to turn them into freaks of synthetic nature. This is wrong, people. They are usurping nature is what is happening. They are stealing the secrets of nature and turning them into abominations. Parker, whose research includes cardiac cell biology, launched the project as a method for learning more about the mysteries of the human heart and a step to our off goal of building an artificial one. But the interdisciplinary project is also sparking interest in other fields, from marine biology to robotics. Parker is not a roboticist, but as an Army veteran who did two tours in Afghanistan, he welcomes any part his stingrays could play. Oh, God, the DOT, in advancing the development of machines able to perform dangerous jobs. Biohybrid machines, things with synthetic parts as well as living materials, they are going to happen, said Parker. So that's what they're calling biohybrid machines. I've spent time getting shot at and seeing people get shot, and if I could bring a cyborg so my buddy doesn't have to crawl into that ditch to look for an IED, I would do that in a heartbeat. Again, we're feeding the war machine. That's what it's all about. It's all about. And when he first asked postdoctoral researcher Sung Jin Park to help him create the stingray 4 years ago, the bench scientist was doubtful. I had this whole idea of a laser-guided, tissue-engineered stingray made out of a rat, Parker said. And he looked at me like a hog staring at a wristwatch. He was like, have I trusted my career to this yahoo? I think he thought I was unglued. Yeah, well, maybe, I don't know, like cyborg stingrays, robots, remote-controlled. You couldn't even make this stuff up. Indeed, the project to build a stingray was more difficult and expensive. It cost close to $1 million, according to Parker, than either of them ever imagined. In a mechanical engineering by training, Park had to delve into molecular and cellular biology. The team pulled experts from diverse fields, including an ichthyologist, someone who studies fish, to help understand and help replicate a ray's muscle structure and biomechanics. Their work was published in Science just last month. Biologically inspired robots aren't new, ding ding. A precursor to the stingray was a tissue-engineered jellyfish Parker helped create in 2020, also with the aim of understanding the muscular pumping of a heart. But one of the robotic stingray's most intriguing contributions is the way it shows a glimpse of autonomy, says John Long, a professor of biology and cognitive sciences who directs Vassar College's Interdisciplinary Robotics Research Laboratory. By putting in the light control, they have a way of controlling the cells without a nervous system, says Long, who was not involved in the stingray research. We used to control puppets with strings, and now we can do it with light. That's frightening. You know, they can even control us with light. We have our circadian rhythms that help regulate our body, and they just, there was just a discovery. Oh, I posted a story maybe 2 weeks ago. I reposted it today because I actually didn't end up in the feed about light and circadian rhythm actually having an influence on your bacteria as well. We know how it is to your health and to all kinds of different biological functions within your body. Anyway, for the story off, Long says that the creation could spark new research into autonomous, part-living machines. He envisions a time when a packet of micro-rays could be unleashed into a busted sewage pipe with simple sensors to measure acidity. Yeah, let's release the rays. The little micro biologically part living robots. This is just, I can't, it is so hard for me some mornings to grasp some of this insanity is even being real. I mean, we have reached into Ray Bradbury on steroids. You know, this is like the greatest science fiction novel ever. Except it's really happening. The stingrays in the Harvard lab, Park and his colleagues built then 200 of these tiny creatures during their research and won't be going in any pipe or ocean. They swim in a pool of warm liquid solution filled with sugar and salt, and the cells could not survive outside of a dish and were not designed to, though Long said that it would be possible to give a similar creature, oh no, a skin that wraps up the solution and creates a kind of circulatory system. Oh my God. You know, we just saw not too long ago, a week or two ago, there was a whole story about synthetic blood and this new synthetic blood that they're making that can be put into humans and maybe even give us superpowers or super oxygen to the cells, as well as many other things that they haven't even thought of yet. Remember, your imagination is our only limitation at this point, and we have lunatics running the asylum. I don't want any part of it. Anyway, so they're going to build this little thing, a circulatory system, potentially, and battery power is a big challenge for robots, especially for tiny, lightweight machines, as Long. But creating a living power system of glucose-fed tissue could extend a robot's mission time. And not that I want to give these guys any ideas, but didn't we just see in that smart moat neuronal implant that they were talking about that they were playing with crystal, little sliver of crystal, and utilizing a piezoelectric system where they were pulling out of the environment in order to power the crystal to give them electricity. But, oh, I don't know, guys. It sounds like that might be useful instead of glucose. But, hey, don't ask me. I just pretend to be an engineer on TV or the radio. All right, so talking about little robots, you know, robots are really becoming something that not only is coming in the back door, but they're also trying to bring it in the front door. They want us to get all warm and fuzzy. We just saw, you know, we joked about Jibo and trapping Jibo off a building. Jibo never materialized. I was very happy about that. But just recently, we played some cheesy intro video to some new, now potentially helper robot for the family called Zenbo. Bring out Zenbo, read bedtime stories to Sally, and make sure you tell little Johnny to pull up his pants. We don't want to see any any low-hanging fruit there, Jenny. You know, well, they're also building helper robots. And a lot is going to be for the baby boomer, elderly. There's a new one called Sam. And remember, I told you about anthropomorphizing these technologies. You read about a bunch of different AI that they're all given names. First one pretty much was Watson. But we now have Ross, right? Ross is the artificially intelligent lawyer that's been hired by the first law firm. And I just saw, I don't know, we did a few stories the other day. There was like a female name and then another male name for some other AI in the business. I'm sure there's many more. Well, now there's Sam. Or Zembo, don't forget. But now there's Sam. Sam brings much needed robotic assistance to senior living facilities. Yes, creating a successful robot company based around providing commercial services isn't easy. Although, as of just the last few years, advances in robotic technology have now made that possible. Companies like Savioki have shown that robotics has reached a point where autonomous platforms can operate in semi-structured environments, doing useful tasks reliably and cost-effectively enough to make a compelling business case. Now, they have pretty much warned that robots are coming after our jobs. They formed a White House panel on how we're going to deal with the displacement of millions of workers in varied industries that are going to be displaced by this new revolution. And this is one of those disruptive technologies. Remember, I told you, typically we always used to have a disruptive technology maybe every 20 years, and then it came at 10 years. But now, with the law of accelerating and exponential returns, we are talking about an entire plate of disruptive technologies that are ready to slap us in the face and change everything that we have known as normal, quote unquote, and displace people from having an income. So this is where the universal basic income idea has been floated around, because since there are jobs anymore for people to earn a living, to be able to pay the man, to be able to support themselves, we can't have millions of unemployed people with no cash going hungry without a home, without a job, and getting all unruly now. So we're just going to give you a monthly paycheck to keep you happy, something that'll be sustainable, and all you have to do is sit around and be good. Don't get into trouble now, Johnny. You'll have to take the chip, because we'll have to make sure you're not doing drugs or thinking thoughts that are against what we've told you to think. You need to be on board with this 21st century agenda of bringing it all together and being for climate change, innovation to save planet, surveillance, and Big Brother. Become fully invasive in every cell in your body. But you know what will make us more efficient? We've become a global community now, and as such, too many people, and we need to keep control over it. So if you want your universal basic income, you're going to have to get this little implant. This little implant that, this will be your code number, and this will allow you to wave your hand and spend cash. This is the way it's going to be rolled out. It's all going to be part of some sort of universal ID program, like Brandon Turberville wrote about a few years ago, that rolled out to 1.2 billion people, I believe, was in India. It's programmed by IBM, as a matter of fact. Good old IBM, still in the numbering system for large populations. Yeah, good old IBM. But 1.2 billion people put on a universal ID program, and a lot of what they were using it for was for being able to renew licenses, benefits, and insurances, and identification. Don't think that that wasn't a grand experiment to be able to roll it out globally. I'll guarantee you that that is part of the plan. Anyway, so back to robots. Robots being helpers. Luvuzo, a startup founded in 2013, based in College Park, Maryland. And, you know, that's right where Roomba is as well. Roomba is not only a happy little robot company that vacuums your floor and mows your lawn, but they also had a Defense Department division, which I believe just recently I read got spun off or sold, but they were doing DOD projects as well as making little home helper robots. So this Luvozo is bringing autonomous robots to semi-structured environments with an enormous amount of potential skilled nursing facilities for seniors. They are introducing a robot concierge called Sam, designed to provide frequent check-ins and non-medical care for residents in long-term care settings through autonomous navigation, telepresence, and an innovative fall hazard detection system. The potential market here is enormous, and to find out more, we stopped by Luzovo and spoke with CEO and co-founder David Petricola. Here's an overview of Sam. Note that the robot you see in this video is either an earlier prototype than Luzovo used for pilot projects while rendering. The slick-looking white version is how the robot looks now, which we're not going to play the video. But Sam's main function is an autonomous telepresence platform. One robot is designed to cover one floor of a senior living facility, which works out to about 25 residents and two or three aides. And in many nursing facilities, staff spends a substantial amount of time checking in on residents once every hour or so, more frequently if a resident is a high fall risk. Sam takes over this task by autonomously navigating from room to room at a check-in schedule, and once in a room, remote staff can then use a robot to video conference with the resident in that room, making sure that everything is fine. And if there is a problem, the remote staff can then contact local employees to get things sorted out in person. This is going to be, again, another remote surveillance center. You know, years ago, we used to have our NOC. That was our Network Operations Center. We used to monitor networks for companies, very large companies, as a matter of fact, with thousands of employees and lots of different servers and lots of different connections out to the web and out to the WANs for other locations of their corporation, where then we would be able to alert the IT director the moment a problem was found. A lot of times we could remote desktop in to any of those servers and make corrections before anyone ever knew that there was a problem. Guys, they're looking to do that in many different venues now. Nursing home facility is one, telepresence. They've already been rolling that out in the medical field, God, since the early 2000s. We were selling that a long time ago. But now, they're going to start rolling that out inside of our bodies as well. That's that little smart moat injectable chip that'll have all kinds of capabilities of manufacturing medications and being able to monitor you at a cellular level. You know, how long is it going to be before that won't be required for some of these elderly in living communities? All they got to do is get a little chip and they can get real-time statistics. You know, Nana's going to be kind of out of it with her Alzheimer's, drooling or whatever. Family members are going to decide for Nana's safety, it'll actually be beneficial for her to get the chip. And you know what? You can monitor Nana's statistics real-time at home on your own computer. In 24/7, she's going to have a camera and a display screen on her wall. You could talk to Nana anytime and see how Nana is doing. Call for help. I mean, I definitely can see unlimited applications here, that every step of this way is taking us further and further into the machine. So we have Sam, who's working in elderly facilities, and they can do a central operation center and monitor the old people. We've talked about them having AI that can not only do facial recognition but detect your emotions as well. You know, one of the first applications is going to be whether or not you're having road rage in a car. They've looked at that, and we've seen examples of the software doing that. Well, now there is a new algorithm that is going to be able to predict whether or not children are likely to become criminals in the future. Talk about absolutely scary. You know, we've worried about this pre-crime, and we had already looked at some smart apps that they were working on that would be able to tell whether or not you had a quote-unquote mental disease by your speech patterns. Well, now says, can we predict who will turn to crime? We saw actually an Israeli company that was able to look at facial structure and determine through your facial structure what ethnicity you may be. And through your ethnicity, do statistical analyses to see where there typically is more crime in a typical ethnic vein as the beginnings of pre-crime. But now, Minority Report computers may soon mark out children as quote-unquote likely criminals. This was a post that JJ had posted yesterday. It was pretty interesting. Is it possible to predict whether someone will commit a crime sometime in the future? Well, it sounds like an idea from 2002 science fiction movie Minority Report. But that's what statistical researcher Richard Burke from the University of Pennsylvania, that's where they're doing that CRISPRing humans, hopes to find out from work he has carried out this year in Norway. The Norwegian government collects massive amounts of data about its citizens and associates it with a single identification file. Ding, ding, ding. Their dossier. Burke hopes to crunch the data from the files of children and their parents to see if he can predict from the circumstances of their birth whether a child will commit a crime before their 18th birthday. The problem here is that newborn babies haven't yet done anything, but the possible outcome of Burke's experiment would be to pre-classify some children as quote-unquote likely criminals based on nothing more than the circumstances of their birth. This could be the first step in making Minority Report a reality where people could be condemned for crimes they have not even committed. Burke's work is based on machine learning, ding, and this involves data scientists designing algorithms that teach computers to identify patterns in large data sets. I mean, once they get you into a database, they can splice and dice those numbers any way they want and see patterns and be able to come up with logical deductions, write algorithms, then to query those databases. And there you go. You got a pre-crime capability. Once the computer can identify patterns, it can apply its findings to predict outcomes, even from data sets it has never seen before. For example, the U.S. retail giant Target collected data about the shopping habits of its customers and used machine learning to predict what customers were likely to buy and when. It got into hot water in 2012 when it accurately used its pregnancy prediction model to predict the pregnancy of a high school student in Minnesota. And it's hardly surprising, given the potential using to avoid crime, that in the field of criminology, it has turned to machine learning in an attempt to predict human behavior. It has already been used, for example, to predict whether an offender is likely to commit another crime, and the ability to use machine learning to inform risk assessments in the criminal justice system has been a focus for Burke for a long time now. For example, earlier this year, he looked at whether a person on bail for alleged domestic violence offenses was likely to commit another offense before their next court date, and whether the algorithms used in machine learning can accurately predict behaviors dependent on having as much contextual data as possible. In some of his studies, Burke has used as many as 36 predictors. In each of Burke's experiments, the algorithm was able to predict quite accurately who would be a low-risk individual. For example, he identified 89% of those people unlikely to commit violence, 97% of inmates unlikely to commit serious crimes or misconduct in prison, and 99% of past offenders unlikely to commit a homicide offense. The trouble, though, is that the algorithm was nowhere near as accurate in predicting who would be a high-risk individual. So there are two ways of using Burke's results. First, we could divert resources away from low-risk individuals, and this might involve placing less onerous supervision conditions on domestic violence defendants who are at a low risk of committing another offense. Alternatively, we could target more resources toward high-risk individuals, and this might involve placing inmates at high risk of serious misconduct into higher security prisons. There are two apparent issues with using target high-risk individuals, though. First, there has been relatively little success in predicting who does pose a risk as compared to those who do not pose a risk, a solution that Burke himself concedes. But secondly, Our criminal justice system is premised on the idea that people have free will and might still make the right choice and not commit a crime, even if they do so at the last possible moment. And, you know, that's the fear. Once they've gotten inside your head, remember, your head is your sandbox for being able to determine what is right and what is wrong. And you can think of things that you never do. And just because you think of them, it is not a crime. But at some point in the future, it very well may be a crime to think anything bad against the system. You have that luxury of working through ethical dilemmas on your own. You'll be uploaded and you'll be told what's ethical and what's not. You'll be told you won't need to worry yourself about dealing with any of these questions that should already be decided, because there will be no crime in the future. It'll be like Star Trek. We're all happy horseshit running around the universe trying to fix other people's problems, like the global or interstellar UN. Anyway, generally, though, such decisions are based primarily on past behaviors of a particular individual and not data sets about past behaviors of other individuals. So using predictive behavioral tools, ding, ding, to decide whether or for how long someone should be in has not yet even happened would definitely represent a substantial philosophical shift, like putting you in jail for something you've never done. How insane is that? We would no longer consider people to be innocent until proven guilty, ding, but it would instead see them as guilty by reason of destiny. That's just, you know, we were looking. There were people that were being arrested for potentially aiding, quote-unquote, ISIS under every bed by going to websites and booking a ticket. And I mean, I don't think it's a good idea to be booking a ticket to Islamic countries after being to Islamic websites. But on the other hand, these people hadn't physically done anything when they went to the airport to arrest them. Yeah, there might have been circumstantial evidence that maybe they were planning on doing something. They hadn't actually done anything yet. They had just shown the signs they might do something in the future, and I know they call that conspiracy. And they can't arrest you for conspiracy if you haven't committed a crime. But that gets to be a real slippery slope, especially when it gets into prediction algorithms. Now, this one caught my attention. So though it isn't going after us, it's going to turn around and bite the police right in the ass. Check this out. Police will soon be watched by algorithms. They try to predict misconduct. What? Yes. Is that a good thing? So, you know, for those enforcers who have been out there enforcing Big Brother's, what would you even call it? Orders. Eventually, Big Brother, turn around. You haven't been able to control yourself, Mr. Policeman. And so we're going to have to come at you not only with AI, but I also predict that they're going to use this whole police brutality conundrum as they're moving more and more police departments under the Federal Department of Justice because they have issues running themselves, that they're going to start moving robotics into the field of patrolling. We already have seen that K-5 zipping around parking lots and distance plate scanners and running over toddlers without saying it's sorry. But soon, police are going to be now watched by algorithms that will protect their misconduct. Cops will soon toil under the eye of algorithms that try to predict their actions, but making them accurate enough will be difficult. Police in Charlotte, North Carolina are set to be pigs, ding ding, for a new high-tech approach to improving relationships between cops and citizens. Careful what you ask for. The Charlotte Police Department is working with the University of Chicago researchers to create software that tries to predict whether an officer is likely to have a bad interaction with someone. The claim is that it'll be able to forewarn against everything from impolite traffic stops to fatal shootings. Previous efforts to use algorithms to nudge police to do their jobs better have not worked out. Chicago's police department gave up on a system introduced in the 1990s after resistance from cops who did not like working under its algorithmic eye. Yeah. Well, as well as concerns about trust and retaliation, one problem that the system had was poor accuracy, and although predictive algorithms have improved in the years since, it'll still be a major challenge. Training software to make accurate predictions requires a lot of data, and computing companies such as Google and Facebook have data points by the billions laying around, and large data sets have been a crucial part of recent advances in what? Oh, artificial intelligence. But the data needed to create software that can accurately guess at an individual cop's future actions is surely much scarcer. And accuracy is very important here. If Amazon recommends two movies and you only like one of them, you probably won't feel slighted and misunderstood. But if an algorithm starts offering tips, involves navigating potentially life-threatening scenarios, it better have good advice. But don't worry about it, because you know what? The robot's going to take all our jobs. Scientists predict brain simulators will take over our jobs and the government in the next 100 years. And you know, I think that's quite a kind, long, far out amount of time. I don't think it's going to be 100 years. No way, no how. Economist Robin Hanson's new book, The New Age of M, Work, Love, and Life When Robots Rule the Earth, imagines a not-too-distant future when robots are commonplace in our life. And the smartest of these will be EMS, or brain emulators. These will be super detailed scans of our actual human brain. Once we figure out how to pull that off cheaply, EMS will take over most human jobs. The advantage of EMS is that they're running 1,000 times faster than the actual human brain. And also, you'll be able to copy them. Oh, Kurzweil must be having a wet dream over this one. Wouldn't you rather scan and duplicate your brain or that of Stephen Hawking and have the M do almost everything? Well, the moment when M's will take over is similar to the singularity famously proposed by who? Oh, our good old buddy Ray Kurzweil. But Hanson thinks that a brain M won't come till the next 100 years sooner than the self-aware AI, because there will be recreations of brains rather than harder to create brain consciousnesses. Brain can come as a culmination of the technology we employ, like brain scans and models, and yes, synthetic biology. And one day we'll just know everything there is to know about brains as part of that brain project, and we'll be able to get computers to mimic them. All right, well, that's where we're going to catch up tomorrow, if you can even believe it. We are already finished with an hour. Make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanch is live up next and all kinds of great radio tonight with live 7 o'clock Game On Ron, 8 o'clock Behind the Woodshed with Hal Anthony from this week, and at 10 o'clock live, Antimedia Radio with S. Gibson. All right, guys, make sure you have an awesome Thursday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody take care.
Truth on the Tracks. You can catch every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m.